Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, May 12th, 2014. You know what I did yesterday? I lounged around in my shorts sipping orange juice, reading the Sunday papers. I love it.
If you want to know about the bishop and an actress, if you want to know how to be a star, if you want to know about the stains on the mattress, you can read it in the Sunday papers.
Actually, Joe Jackson, the stains were on a blue dress.
Sunday papers.
Yeah, Monica Lewinsky was in my Sunday papers. So I am a geezer. There's no doubt about it. I grew up reading newspapers, and I still enjoy them very much. And while I get a lot of news on screens now, the little screen on my phone and the big screen on my computer, I prefer to pick up a paper, an actual ink and paper document, and read it. It's just my habit. I also have a near photographic memory for things that are on a printed page, and for whatever reason, that service, that app, doesn't work so well on screens. So today, most of my news and comment will be drawn from what I read in the Sunday papers with some updates, leading with this update on the Eastern Ukraine, where they called an election, and there was some participation. But it was a really slipshod effort. There was no international monitoring. And they announced results of paper ballots that had been printed on photocopiers within 2 hours of the polls closing. And they came up with the same incredible type numbers that occurred in the reports of the initiative in Ukraine, in Crimea, just a month or two ago. So according to results from eastern Ukraine, 89% of voters in the Donetsk region and 97.5% in neighboring Luhansk voted for greater autonomy. But even the wording of the initiative wasn't clear on exactly what that means. And leaders of the separatist group have asked to be brought into Russia, to be folded into Russia, to be annexed. That's the word I'm looking for. And Moscow is saying, I don't know. The authorities in Moscow have avoided any suggestion that they would use the results in the same way they had used the Crimean Peninsula referendum in March. Within 48 hours of that vote, Putin had given a speech from the Kremlin declaring that Russia would annex Crimea. But this time they said it respects the Kremlin, respects the will of the population, and that the outcome should be reached through dialogue between representatives of Easterners and the national government in Kiev. So this is a very, you know, surprising kind of shift on the part of Moscow. And the idea that they are promoting dialogue seems, well, a little out of character. We also know that last week in his comments, Putin kind of softened his opposition to the elections in Ukraine, still scheduled for the 25th of May. And, of course, in the meantime, the situation is really fluid and very unpredictable. So we will continue to watch this. Now, in my Sunday New York Times, one of these surprise stories buried on page A16 is that Russia keeps adding to the total tally of the bill for natural gas that Ukraine owes to Moscow. Now, this is going to get a little complicated, so, you know, pay attention as much as you like. Here's the big picture, all right? At the end of March, Gazprom, the Russian gas company, said that Kiev owed about $1.89 billion for unpaid gas. Now, that amount was in part based on a deal that Moscow had made with Yanukovych, who, of course, was ousted from Kiev in March, and they had reduced the rate of the, you know, of a cubic unit of natural gas to a special deal, down to $268. And once the Yanukovych government was relieved of duty, well, Moscow relieved Kiev of the discount. So that added another $3.5 billion to the alleged bill. Now, to get to $22 billion, you got to do some really amazing math. Russia is claiming that Ukraine signed a contract to use certain amounts of gas, and then consumption declined sharply in Ukraine. So they had committed to buy 50 billion cubic meters a year, but they only bought 28 billion last year because of a recession in Ukraine. And so Moscow is billing them for unused gas. And that amounts to another $13 billion. And then just for extra measure, they insist that Ukraine must pay $4 to $5 billion in advance for any gas shipments to be sent into Ukraine and then stored underground for use this coming winter. So there's no question that the adding machine the Kremlin is using has political additions. But it really is a stark display of the leverage that Moscow has, not only on Ukraine and its American allies and its NATO allies, but on customers in Europe. A lot of the gas that goes to Europe from Russia flows through Ukraine. And so it just underscores the point I've been making for weeks. Because of the gas, because of the energy control that Moscow has, Putin is in control of this dance. And it's interesting that he doesn't seem to be that keen on annexing anything beyond Crimea. We know the Navy base there was critical to Russia. Oh, that's another part of the gas deal. When the Crimean annexation occurred, it canceled another price deal, a discount that Ukraine had, and added more to this $22 billion tally. And as we have discussed most recently with Pepe Escobar in our Boiling Frogs Post interview that was posted last week, the big picture here is that Russia is moving closer to China, making deals on oil and gas with China that will not be based on the petrodollar. The exchange will either be in the yuan or in the ruble or maybe both. But this could sharply weaken the influence that the U.S. has on a global basis. And that appears to be one of the goals of Putin in this standoff, where Ukraine and Crimea are simply proxies for the big picture struggle between the U.S. and Russia. Now, before I get to this next story, I want to share with you an email I got over the weekend from Alex. And I'm not sure if Alex is a male or a female. I do know that Alex is from the United Kingdom. And Alex writes in response to an item that I put in our News and Comment podcast on Friday, and I did flag it quite carefully, and Alex here notes that. I used a source that I could not find any corroboration for to report that 14 alleged CIA contractors working for Greystone had a helicopter or two that they were in shot down in eastern Ukraine. And the report from this EU Times indicated that 13 of those mercenaries had been killed, and that the lone survivor was disarmed and just kind of left to disappear. So Alex writes, "I have too much respect for the integrity of your reporting, analysis, and commentary, thank you, not to warn you about using EU Times as a source, particularly regarding Russia. Even with a health warning attached," referring to the flag that I gave it, "it's not worth the reputational damage. EU Times isn't an actual newspaper, it's a news aggregator. Usually their sensational Russian reporting stems from a very dodgy site that uses made-up Russian government agencies, secret reports, and sources to give their fiction an air of truth." So, Alex, I appreciate that warning, and I will certainly take heed. But as I explained in Friday's podcast, the reason I used that item is to see if we do get any confirmation of American mercenaries in Ukraine. And voila, in a post at RT, that's Russia Today. Yes, that is a Russian news agency. They've got the RT cable channel here in the United States. But they cite a report from the German newspaper Bild am Sonntag, And that report indicates that about 400 mercenaries from the new notorious U.S. private security firm Akademi, or I never know how they pronounce that, formerly Blackwater, are taking part in the Ukrainian military operation against anti-government protesters in southeastern regions of the country. The Bildam Sontag newspaper, citing a source in intelligence circles, wrote Sunday that Akademi employees are involved in the Kyiv military crackdown on pro-autonomy activists near the town of Slavyansk. In particular, it says, Greystone Limited, which is currently registered in Barbados and is a part of Akademi Corporation, is a candidate for such a gendarme role. Now, by describing it as a candidate, that means they don't have confirmation that any of these people work for Greystone or Akademi. So, what we have now are two reports, still of dubious credibility. But I believe that you, as one of my listeners, deserve to hear this information, tuck it in the back of your mind, and we'll see if additional data or accounts surface that provide more persuasive information. But I would not be at all surprised if American mercenaries are operating in Ukraine. In fact, I'd be shocked if the reverse happens to be true. So we will continue to follow this, but as I say, I like to share information and appropriately warn people about the sourcing, and then you can evaluate that for yourself. I like to thank the people who support my work here through their subscriptions. Marianne Razzo, Carol Krez, the folks at Lightworks Art, and Gary Washington are the people who get a shout-out today for their continued subscriber support of my work. I hope you'll join them, and I'm honest about this. We've had some cancellations recently for various reasons, so I need to expand the ranks of subscribers, and I'm looking at you, because Roger Barr, he just broke down and said he'd been hearing me ask for support, and finally, over the weekend, he took out an annual subscription. Thank you, Roger. I really appreciate that vote of confidence. I hope you'll join Roger and the others. Go to the website, click on the link that says sign up. It's right under my picture. Choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Best deal is our $50 annual subscription. You get the bonus gifts if you're in the U.S. and take out a new annual subscription. The rock and roll CD Red Flag by John Dist, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. Now, we've been talking about Ukraine. Also in the Sunday papers, over the weekend, interesting coverage about problems with pipelines and oil and gas facilities. First up, a federal report that came out from the Transportation Department's Office of Inspector General, saying that the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration is not ensuring that key state inspectors are properly trained. 85% of the pipelines are under state authority. And as we'll point out in a minute about the big gas pipeline explosion in San Bruno, just south of San Francisco in 2010, where 8 people were killed, 38 homes were destroyed, we have not seen an appropriate response to tighten up pipeline inspections across this country. And more than 20% of the nation's total gas distribution pipelines are over 50 years old, or composed of materials such as cast iron or bare steel that's more susceptible to failure than new pipeline materials. And the utilities, like my rogue utility here in Northern California, Pacific Gas and Electric, are making decisions about saving money against the risk of killing more people and blowing up more property. So, after the San Bruno explosion, PG&E agreed to spend $300 million to try to find out where its pipelines are buried. Now, this is stunning that a utility of this size had to admit that they really didn't know where all their pipes are in the ground. And so they've spent $300 million to update and rebuild their records. And in the spot check of the inspections of these reports, for example, among the 20 sets of pipeline records that auditors picked at random, documentation on 11 of them was either missing, erroneous, or rife with inconsistencies. Then there was an audit in January. Engineers working on the audit sampled 42 of the pipeline evaluations and found the company had made mistakes on 12 of them. Now, I could accept, you know, some margin of error, but at this level? And let me give you this update. This is purely anecdotal. I do not profess to say that this reflects on Pacific Gas and Electric overall. But my next-door neighbor has a gas line that leaves the ground for about a 10-foot stretch in front of their house. It is perfectly visible at all times. And so he put in a request a couple of years ago to get them to replace the gas line coming into his house and to bury it in the ground so it's not exposed. I mean, it's ugly and it's risky. So about 6 weeks ago, there were 11 workers, four trucks, who came out. They dug up the street. They spent all day there. And then they threw up their hands and said they couldn't find their own gas main. This is after the guy had come in with the sonar device, you know, whatever they use to read what's under the ground. And he spray painted all along the street, you know, here's the gas line and here's the sewer line and here's the water line, blah, blah, blah. Well, last week, there were two signs put up saying that they were going to come back and try to finish the job. But they didn't. Maybe they were diverted to look for pipelines somewhere else in the state. I don't know. The other report that's troubling is that oil and gas facilities that are located on federal lands, including Native American lands, which are under the control of the Interior Department's Bureau of Land Management, also suffer from failures to inspect thousands of these wells that are considered potentially high risks for water contamination and other environmental harm. And about 60% of the sites that are considered high priority have not been inspected since the time of this report, 2009 through 2012. So as we look at the prospect that Obama will cave and approve the Keystone XL pipeline, we just have here more data that tells us that these pipelines are not safe and that they're not properly inspected. So it puts us at greater risk. And the tar sands crude that they want to pump through Keystone XL will be heated to 120 degrees, and the pressure will be elevated to 800 pounds per square inch. The gas lines that exploded in San Bruno only had 400 PSI on them. The Keystone XL with this ugly sludge crude will be pumped through at 1,800 PSI. And you can easily understand that a crack in the line, a bad weld, an accident with something that hits the pipeline could create a calamity in short order. Well, back to my Sunday papers. I want to commend the New York Times and Adam Liptak, their Supreme Court correspondent, for a really good analysis piece. And I'll give you the bottom line first and then kind of back into the analysis. The bottom line is that today, the Supreme Court is completely polarized along political lines. And what the Times does, going all the way back to the 1950s, to the Eisenhower presidency, they show that over the years, there were always members of each party who were kind of anomalous. What do I mean by that? That not all of the Republicans were conservative, not all the Democrats were liberal. And in recent years, we had two Republicans, David Souter and John Paul Stevens, who both turned out to be far more liberal than the other Republicans and were often as liberal or more liberal than some of the Democrats. And today, the composition of the court is divided purely along partisan lines, especially as the swing voter Anthony Kennedy has found more comfort with the right than with the left. And when the Times looked at the top 10, you know, critical decisions that have come out of the court in recent years, it's not the top 10, it's just top cases. They show that conservatives won 10 times, including the decision striking down the core provision of the Voting Rights Act, and that the liberals won 6 times, including a ruling requiring the federal government to provide benefits to married same-sex couples. The notable exception was when Chief Justice Roberts crossed party lines to vote to uphold Obamacare. But this is a very important documentation of the way the court has been packed. And it screams, to me anyway, that if Obama gets at least one more nomination for the court, that he has to choose a hardcore liberal. It's the only way to try to balance the court. And that becomes less and less likely when you look at the probable outcome of the U.S. Senate races this fall. It's very hard at this point to see the Democrats holding on to even a slim majority. And because they have been so weak in blocking Republican nominees in the past few years, and because Obama has been nominating corporate pro-government centrists like Kagan and Sotomayor, well, the legacy we may have is a court that moves even more to the right in future years. A couple of more items from my Sunday New York Times, and I want to credit the Times for taking on the Roman Catholic Church. Frank Bruni, one of the op-ed columnists at the Times, reports on a practice that just surfaced here in the news in the Bay Area this past week, and that is that across the country, Catholic bishops are now requiring lay teachers in Catholic schools to sign contracts that include detailed morals clauses, and they are required to comply with certain moral teachings of the Catholic Church, mostly related to sexuality. So, no abortion, no support for same-sex couples or even homosexual behavior. And it is a real crackdown on the free thinking of people who teach in Catholic schools. And I find it extremely ugly. And here's how Frank Bruni characterizes it. The new contract expressly forbids a homosexual lifestyle and any public support of one. But it says nothing about public support of the death penalty, something else that the church opposes. The new contract specifically rules out any use or advocacy of abortion rights, surrogacy, and even in vitro fertilization. But it doesn't address possible advocacy of the sorts of bloody military engagements that the church often condemns. One more whack. The new contract forbids living together outside marriage, sexual activity out of wedlock, and any public endorsement of either. But there's no reference to concern for the downtrodden, to the spirit of giving, to charity. And while those are surely more difficult to monitor, aren't they as essential to Catholic principles and closer to the core of the faith? Well, the other dioceses where these contracts are being imposed include my old hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio, and the islands of Hawaii. Teachers are revolting. That's not... That's not an attempt to make light of teachers. Yes, many are refusing. There are some who are retiring in their objection to signing these agreements, and others are becoming vocal and trying to push back. And get this. The bishops are describing the employment agreement as a teacher-minister contract. So they're taking people who are not ministers in any way. Many of them are not even members of the Roman Catholic Church. They simply teach at a Catholic school. And so by being characterized as teacher ministers, they're hoping to comply with a Supreme Court ruling that permits religious organizations to impose its standards on people who are ministering that faith. But if you're a science teacher at a Catholic high school, does that make you a minister? If you're a football coach, if you teach English? This is really insulting. And it's the kind of patriarchal, infantilizing approach that unfortunately is par for the course when you talk about the Catholic bishops. The other whack at Catholics is aimed at Pope Francis, and it comes from Maureen Dowd, whose column is impishly titled With Malice Toward Nuns. And you may know that under Pope Benedict, the Vatican started trying to limit the expression, particularly of American Catholic nuns, and to force them into submission, frankly. It's a very ugly, misogynist, and patriarchal process, and it appears that Pope Francis is condoning it. Now, a biographer says that as an archbishop, Francis appeared to support activist women in the Roman Catholic Church. But now that he's pope, he seems to be more comfortable with the Vatican line. I encourage you to read both Bruni and Dowd's columns in the Sunday New York Times. And last week, we spent quite a bit of coverage on Cecily McMillan, the 25-year-old Occupy Wall Street organizer who was roughed up by a cop and convicted of assaulting that police officer. She's facing 7 years in prison. And over the weekend, she got some famous visitors. Two members of the Russian punk band Pussy Riot were able to visit her at the Rikers Island prison in New York. Let me see if I can get their names. This is the real reason I wanted to mention this, just to see if I can conquer. Nadezhda Tilakanova. Okay. Nadezhda and her colleague Maria Alyakina. Those are tongue twisters, and let me see if I can regain control of mine. Thanks for listening today to my news and comment. You're authorized to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. I hope you will. Go ahead and put it up on Facebook. Tell everybody you like it. Thanks.
Happy trails.